Welcome. Good evening. For those who've been practicing Zen for a little while or a long while, or those who haven't been at all and are interested in maybe taking it up. What for? What's the reason for you to practice Buddha Dharma, Zen, meditation? Anything come to mind off the top of your head? Okay. Yes?
For me, it's discovering the true self and to become loving the world.
Mm-hmm. What would be the point of discovering the true self? For the sake of truth itself.
For the sake of truth itself, because I am. And so is everyone else.
Thank you. Anyone else? Yes, Richard.
I find myself suffering in life and not living as rich a life as I could live.
Really? Amazing.
It helps me calm down, which I need in order to become more open, loving, and more an instrument of peace.
So I hear these similar stories. One side is the kind of problem side of that we're not necessarily calm. We're sometimes stressed, or there's anxiety in our life, and there's suffering, and we want to be free. And our version of free may be calm, our true self, and loving and kind and compassionate and shining that light in the world is the kind of positive side, is that they go together. Well, I think those are very natural intentions for such a practice. I think the Buddha's teaching and the Zen teachings were offered for such intentions. So, you may be on the right track. We could, again, there's positive and negative side. There's the problems that we want to be free from, or free with. Greed, hate, and delusion are sometimes called the causes of suffering, but you could almost say that they are suffering. When we look at, like, well, what is the suffering in my life? It's often manifest in the form of greed or attachment, hate or aversion, delusion or confusion. Sometimes those are called the three poisons, because they don't taste very good, and they we don't feel very good when we drink them. Sometimes it's said there's five poisons. You add in pride and jealousy. This is three roots: greed, hate, and delusion. But pride is maybe a little bit on the maybe pride and jealousy are both a little bit on the greed side, but they get their own category sometimes because they're not exactly just attachment, right? They're relational, and they're a little different. And so we want to be free from these kleshas, these poisons, these disturbing emotions, we can call them. Because I think that's most of our problems are around these three or five disturbing emotions. And then on the positive side, the Buddha would speak about nirvana. It can be translated as freedom. And sometimes the Buddha defined nirvana as the freedom from these poisons. Or in the early teachings, he got quite explicit and said, actually, it's the end. It's the cessation of greed, hate, and delusion. That's what we call nirvana, like complete peace and freedom from mental disturbance. And that we could call this nirvana, like our true self, and that can shine in the world for the benefit of beings. So this all goes together, I think, everything everyone said, and I'm sure everybody else's responses for why we practice could fit into this this way of looking at practices, addressing these disturbing emotions and being free from them. So the early version is kind of black and white. Free from them maybe means actually ending them completely so that they never arise again. You might think, is this even possible? Some of us studying the Pali Canon this past year, I think some of these questions came up. This sounds very idealistic. Is it possible? I think it may be possible. But in the later teachings that evolved, culminating in traditions such as Zen, it's not necessarily that it's just about ending greed, hate, and delusion. It is about freedom, but we might say freedom in the midst of greed, hate, and delusion. Freedom, they continue to arise, but we're not so dragged down by them. We're not so caught up in these afflictive emotions, these disturbing emotions. So the version of what freedom is maybe evolves a little bit over time from this very black and white. It's greed, hate, and delusion is not freedom. Ending them, the complete cessation of them forevermore is freedom. Zen, we might say, as the tradition evolved, the understanding of the practice became more and more non-dual, we could say. And non-dual in this case means not getting into this distinction of greed, hate, and delusion and the ending of them. It's more like, let's just look really clearly at what greed, hate, and delusion are. And as they continue to arise, can we be free in that? And in a way, when we're free in the midst of them arising as a human life, then maybe we don't act out on them so strongly and don't harm others as much, and we can respond more compassionately, even though maybe still continue to arise and cease moment to moment. Greed, hate, and delusion. Pride and jealousy may be a little harder to see. They're not quite as maybe obvious, and they don't seem maybe quite as harmful on the surface. But I think they can be harmful. Right? pride, especially unconscious pride, we might unconsciously put others down, and jealousy or envy, we might not appreciate others' merits and goodness. We're about to embark on a 7-day Rohatsu Sesshin, we call it. Sesshin, gathering the mind, silent retreat to celebrate Buddha's great enlightenment, great awakening, Buddha's realization of nirvana, Buddha's freedom from the poisonous, disturbing emotions. You know, I think he sat with his disturbing emotions for a long time and really got very intimate with them, got to really see them. It's sometimes depicted in artwork on that eve of, in the Zen tradition, we say December 8th. Rohatsu means December 8th. So that falls somewhere in the middle of our sesshin. On that eve of his enlightenment, there's the artwork where all these kind of demons are attacking him and, you know, shooting arrows and throwing weapons, hurling rocks and mountains at the Buddha. I think it's just an artistic depiction of these disturbing emotions in the Buddha's own mind. That's how it feels sometimes, doesn't it? Like arrows and rocks being hurled at us. But they're not really coming from outside. And at some point, that attack ended. Buddha saw through all that stuff and came to peace. So this retreat, we celebrate that. This ending of the year, time. And in the Zen tradition, Rohatsu Sesshin is kind of a culmination of the year of practice. Here and other places too, it's the longest, most intensive sesshin or retreat of the year, and it's a chance to sit deeply with our own disturbing emotions, getting to the bottom of them, sitting right in the heart of the disturbing emotions, and maybe finding some freedom. So many people here are doing this sesshin or parts of it, and everybody's welcome to come attend basically any parts of it. The way we've been doing these kind of sesshins recently is it's nice to commit to whole days or the whole thing. And some people are doing both of those, but also it's drop-in style. Except for where we have formal meals in the Zendo, you can't really drop into those. But all the zazen throughout the day, from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m., you're welcome. You're all welcome to stop in and join in this energy of diligent investigation of our own minds for the benefit of all beings. Recently came across a bodhisattva vow by Tore Zenji. So many of you might know of Hakuin, the great Rinzai Zen reviver in Japan in the 1700s. So his main disciple is named Tore, and Tore wrote this short bodhisattva vow that is sometimes chanted before Dharma talks in the Rinzai Zen tradition, or chanted different times of the day. We have Dogen's vow that we chant often before Dharma talks. So it's that style. It's a short inspiration from Tore, how he wants to practice and wants to encourage us to practice. So I find it inspiring. So I'll share it with you. When I, a student of Dharma, look at the real form of the universe, all is the never-failing manifestation of the mysterious truth of the Tathagata. I will always be a student of the Dharma, always learning more about this universe. And when I look at the real form of the universe, all, everything, is the never-ending manifestation of the mysterious truth of the Tathagata. Everything that appears to us is a manifestation of the Buddha, the mysterious truth of the thus come Buddha. In every event, in every moment, and in every place, none can be other than the marvelous revelation of its glorious light. This realization made our founding teachers and virtuous Zen ancestors extend tender care with the heart of great respect, even to such beings as birds and beasts. This realization reveals to us that our daily food and drink, clothes and protections of life, are the warm flesh and blood, the merciful incarnation of Buddha. So we honor and respect all beings, birds and beasts and earthworms and so on. And this revelation that everything is the glorious light of the Tathagata teaches us that our daily food and drink, our clothes and our all the things that we deal with in our everyday life are all the warm flesh and blood, the merciful incarnation of Buddha. Isn't that a wonderful offering? And maybe it's, you know, in the form of Tore's vow that he wishes to remember this himself. I vow to remember in my daily life that the food I'm eating, the clothes I'm wearing, the street I'm walking on, the car I'm driving, the sounds of the horns out there, all of this is the flesh and blood of the Buddha, the merciful incarnation of Buddha. Buddha can incarnate, can take the form and body of everything. Who can be ungrateful or not respectful even to inanimate things, not to speak of human beings? When one sees this way, even to, you know, a cup of water, we see if this is the flesh and blood of the Buddha's glorious light, then we want to respectfully take care of it very naturally. And really deeply appreciate, amazing that this comes to us. Right? Not to mention humans, our species. Even if someone may be a fool, be warm and compassionate. If by any chance such a person should turn against us, become a sworn enemy, and abuse and persecute us, we should sincerely bow down with humble speech in reverent belief that he or she is the merciful avatar of Buddha who uses skillful devices to emancipate us from harmful karma that's been produced and accumulated by our own selfish delusion and attachment through countless cycles of kalpas. So if someone's a fool, still, of course, be warm and compassionate. But even if they go further than just being a fool and turn against us, abuse and persecute us, we should, or maybe we could hear this as Tori saying, I vow to, when encountering such a situation, to sincerely bow down with humble speech and reverent belief that she's the merciful avatar of Buddha, the incarnation, the manifestation of Buddha, using the Buddha's skillful device to help us. The Buddha's manifesting as this harmful person to help us learn patience and respect and gratitude. And it, you know, and if it's particularly harmful to us, we can think, the Buddha must think that I'm a pretty good practitioner if they think I can handle this person. We don't want to get too proud about it. Yes, Richard.
I'm interrupting at this point because this is always a key for me. This always comes up. So we have a Hitler, and we're in a situation.
Got to get Hitler in the story.
Well, the Hitler story.
Yeah.
And then we bow in compassion and respect and understand that this is a great test to us, and we kill him.
Maybe, yeah. It may be that that's what we do. If we're killing him not out of revenge and disrespect, but if we're killing him just to prevent him from killing others.
Have great respect and, to the universe. And...
Mm-hmm. Or even it may be that we kill him so that he doesn't build up any more extremely harmful karma himself. Like, he's done enough, let's stop him. He's gonna have some difficult lifetimes after this one. Let's actually try to minimize that impact for him by, like, this life is gonna keep going off track. Let's just stop him. It may be that it's like that. If it's someone, you know, less blatant than Hitler, maybe. Hopefully, we don't have to kill them. And we can, by actually respectfully bowing with gratitude, maybe they actually wake up right in the midst of their action. So I think this kind of... Yes?
Okay. I have a question about the stanza before.
Oh, the stanza before. Who can be ungrateful or not respectful even to inanimate things? Yeah.
The transformation of the blood. And
yeah.
What does that mean? I hear the Catholicism in it. What does it mean here?
Our daily food and drink are the warm flesh and blood of the Buddha. I think it's, you know, it's a poetic way of saying the living, actual, like, life of Buddha. The warm flesh and blood of Buddha. Not just some, like, kind of picture of Buddha. But the actual, we say, like, sometimes we say the Bodhisattva precepts are the blood vein of Buddha. So in that same spirit, the living, flowing, warm life energy of Buddha manifests as like a teacup. It's kind of like a surprising thing to hear. When I read this, I feel like, wow. That is quite a statement, Tori. But it moves me, you know. It moves. I would like to see this as the flesh and blood of the Buddha. We're not talking about Shakyamuni Buddha. I don't think we're not talking about a particular person that's magically emanating objects to teach us. I think we're talking about the Dharmakaya Buddha, the vast. Formless realm of reality itself, open, clear, empty of any fixed reference points, that reality is expressed each moment as, you know, reference points like a teacup and, you know, individual things. So then if we see them as not just the reference point of a teacup 1 foot in front of this body, you know, located right here, but we see it that way, but we also appreciate that it, at the same time, this is some is inconceivable suchness, and it's alive with the life of the Buddha, something like that. Yeah.
You know, appreciation of the teachings, the wisdom of the teachings, and that it's, you know, fabulous to think about the teacup or the cushion as, you know, really this, an existence is amazing, how amazing this is, and really unknowable.
Mm-hmm.
And to think of the other, it just started to feel like it was leaning towards Buddha as a god, really, you know. I don't know if
that's
there.
Buddha is just reality. Completely empty and ungraspable, and takes the form of everything we can see and seem to grasp. So I don't think there's anything like metaphysical going on here, but it's a pointing out what we actually mean by Buddha. And it's saying, we can use that word Buddha, instead of just saying the emptiness of the vast universe, we can say Buddha manifests Buddha's flesh and blood because it's beautiful to talk that way. And it startles us maybe more if we just say, emptiness is form. Sometimes we say it like that, but we're so used to hearing it that way, it might not startle us. But if we say this teacup is the flesh and blood of the living Tathagata, that we it startled you, right?
It startled me.
Yes, Carla. Yeah, and it almost never helps to throw it back. It just escalates the whole situation, usually. So if we can practice in this way, and you know, we can come up with all kinds of concerns about this kind of thing. Like, well, you know, if somebody's really abusing somebody, do we just let them I mean, that's sort of a Hitler question, I think. So we always have that side too. But I think our problem is generally we don't fall into that passivity thing so much. I think we generally fall into the other side, at least I do, of the, you know, reacting and, you know, not appreciating people who are giving me a hard time. So... Yeah.
All these demons or blocks. In a way, whenever somebody does something mean to us, we have the same experience.
Yeah, so I think that's what he's actually saying here, is like, can we see this through his language is saying, instead of saying energy, he's saying it's a skillful means of the Buddha. And that's, but it's the same point, I think, as you could say, it's impersonal energy coming from the interdependence of the universe through this person, you know, and we call, and he's saying, he's using this traditional Buddhist language of, well, that's the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the big universal Buddha, is manifesting through this person, and there's some, the person isn't intentionally doing this as skillful means, but from the point of view of the large universe, we could see it as the universe is trying to awaken everybody to reality, and it's doing it through sometimes really painful situations. Nettie?
I've been thinking about this point a lot lately, and what I've been thinking about is when somebody does something that is harmful to us, if I can respond and maintain my precepts at the same time, that feels like the most fantastic opportunity. Like that.
That's a nice way to put it. Mm-hmm.
That moment where something happens and some sort of response is required of some sort, can I do that and maintain the precept, my version of them, not someone else's, but mine? Like that's just such an energetic moment.
Yeah.
That can be
our guideline is the Bodhisattva precepts. So we might still be able to have a very energetic response, very not kind of passive, very energetic, but it's still in accord with the Bodhisattva precepts. We can say, especially, yeah, is this lying? Is it speaking of others' faults? Is it praising self and belittling others? Is there possessiveness or ill will and so on? It's like, no, but there's an intense response. And then that's beautiful, yeah.
I think that can be applied to even these extreme kind of Hitler type questions. People did respond with great determination, mm-hmm. great persistence, and they did it while having no hatred.
Yeah.
And they did it without hatred.
Mm-hmm.
They really did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's possible. Difficult.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't want to veer away from the Hitler. I think that for me, it's everything comes from the original aspect. So if there's emotion being brought up for me, I look at it and I can exaggerate that emotion to a delusional degree. So then, once I'm in the delusion, then the next thing is fear, and then the next thing is defense.
Yeah.
So, I do think in very intense situations of emotion that for some people, exaggeration and illusion is a big thing.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, with these, going back to the three poisons, three disturbing emotions of greed, hate, and delusion, throw in pride and jealousy if we want. Delusion is the root of all the others. And particularly, I mean, there's many aspects of delusion, but here in the Dharma story, the root delusion, again, we could define it different ways, but I would say is the the kind of hidden unconscious view that of the independent self, of me as a kind of like entity, of me as an entity, not as a conditioned flow that's just response to other conditioned flows, but that there's somebody here that's like in charge, that there's some controller at the source called me. That kind of view or belief, I would say, is the root delusion from which greed and attachment arises, aversion, anger, hatred arises, pride arises, jealousy arises, and all the 108,000 other obscurations. So there's other kinds of delusions too, but that one, I think, if we can find that one, is the one that we can really study this sesshin and for the rest of our life. It's hard, very hard to study because it's so subtle, this sense that there's this me here that is like number one. That seems to be the root issue. And we can check that out in our own experience in Zazen and for the rest of our life.
Can I just add that,
yes.
That I think for myself, with what I'm learning from my experience interacting with others is that not to exaggerate emotion, but to learn how to balance emotion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we can not over-exaggerate it or necessarily eliminate it, but actually just be free in the midst of the arising emotion. Yeah, it's hard to find the balance. We like to go into the extremes of either, like, can I just eliminate this forever and get rid of it because it's so painful? Or can I totally indulge it and, like, act out on it in every possible way? Those are the two extremes. So the middle way of just the balanced emotion, did you call? Yeah, it's very hard to find.
Accepting the reality of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not exaggerating.
Yeah, not exaggerating. Or also from this point of view of the root delusion of the independent self, one way to look at it is based on this view of the controlling essential me, then for, from beginningless time, attachment and aversion, pride and jealousy have arisen. So we can start to dismantle this view through carefully examining it and releasing it. And then, but still, because the habits have been created since beginningless time, probably attachment, aversion, pride and jealousy and other kind of confusions are going to keep arising because they have some heavy duty momentum from, we might say billions of lifetimes, or we might say at least from the beginning of this life. So then a balanced emotion could be like, I see that there's still this attachment, but it's not exactly my attachment now. It used to be all in relation to me, and then I am trying to stop this attachment. And I'm getting all caught up in that. Now I can see there's a dependently arising attachment. The whole universe, that's actually kind of a manifestation of the warm flesh and blood of the Buddha, is coming through this body and mind as like, I want some more of this here, I'm like, wow. But now we can see that, we might be able to see that it's not so much that there's this me that needs to have this. It's like it's a conditioned response, and we can take it a little bit more lightly. We still want it, and we're still going to drink it, but it's more balanced now. We can treat it more lightly, and then if somebody says, "Actually, give it to me, I want to drink it instead. And we go, okay, you know, I don't really have to have it. Something like that could happen. Yes, getting ready for Christmas. Then, on each moment's flash of thought, this is when we start to see, well, back up a little bit. This is Toure saying, when people, like, push our buttons, he says, then we can, you know, sincerely, humbly receive them in reverent belief that they are these merciful manifestations of Buddha coming to help free us from all our karmic effects. If the more we see that way and practice that way, very challenging, right? I would like to vow this with Toure, but I know it will be difficult. But if so, then on each moment's flash of thought, there will grow a lotus flower, and on each lotus flower will be revealed a Buddha. These Buddhas will glorify the Pure Land every moment and everywhere. So Helen might think, wait a second, what's going? This sounds kind of magical again. On each moment's flash of thought, this is where, like the thought of, like, when are we going to get out of here, you know? And then say, oh, actually that thought is a manifestation of the Buddha. Then on that moment's thought, when are we going to get out of here, a lotus blooms. When are we going to... On top of that thought, or out of that thought, there's a lotus, and on top of that lotus, there's a Buddha, and on that Buddha will glorify the Pure Land. And I think this is the Pure Land, right? That this Pure Land where everything, all the food, drink, clothes, angry people, fools, and everything that's happening is a manifestation of the universal Dharma body of the Buddha. That's what we call the Pure Land. And when we start to open to that, then on each moment there's this lotus with a Buddha on it, and that Buddha is glorifying the Pure Land that we're already in. May we extend this mind to all beings so that we and the world together may attain maturity in Buddha's wisdom. Those who hear this truth even once and listen with a grateful heart, treasuring it and revering it, gain blessings without end. And he goes on for a while more, and then he finishes by saying, truly, is anything missing right now? Nirvana is right here before our eyes. This very place is the lotus land. This very body, the Buddha. May we vow to open to Toure's vision of a beneficent universe. And just briefly to close, today is Suzuki Roshi's annual Memorial Day, December 4th, on the first morning of Rohatsu Sesshin in 1971, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi at San Francisco Zen Center left this manifestation of we call the world, this world, and he had a lot of fun while he was in it, and I hope he enjoyed what came next. So just to mention some words from Suzuki Roshi on his day, his memorial day. Our Soto Zen way puts an emphasis on shikan taza, or just sitting. Actually, we don't have any particular name for our practice. When we practice Zazen, we just practice it. And whether we find joy in our practice or not, we just do it. Even though we're sleepy and we're tired of practicing Zazen, of repeating the same thing day after day, even so, we continue our practice. Whether or not someone encourages our practice, we just do it. Even when you practice Zazen alone without a teacher, I think you'll find some way to tell whether your practice is adequate or not. When you're tired of sitting or when you're disgusted with your practice, you should recognize this as a warning signal. You become discouraged with your practice when your practice has been idealistic. You have some gaining idea in your practice, and therefore it's not pure enough. I think that's such a great thing. You have this idealistic idea, which is in a way like wanting a more pure practice, right? Purity is kind of idealistic idea. Pure, my practice is kind of impure. He says, because your practice is idealistic, it's not pure enough. It's kind of like, tempting. Are you going to get a gaining idea now? You purify your practice by getting rid of your gaining ideas. I don't know if you realize that he said that. Your practice isn't pure enough because you think you should be more pure. It's when your practice is rather greedy that you become discouraged with it. So you should be grateful that you have a sign or warning signal to show you the weak point in your practice. At that time, forgetting all about your mistake and renewing your way, you can resume your original practice. This is a very important point. So mistake in practice is thinking it should be some different way. And the warning signal is that that points out this mistake is you're discouraged. Like, my practice isn't good enough. You feel like, I really can't practice very well. And this is a good one for anyone going into sesshin, because sesshin, it breaks down your sense of being able to do it. I remember one elder Zen teacher at Tassajara once in sesshin saying, "Sesshin is making mincemeat out of me." We often feel that way. Very good for that reason, because it points out this, this problem in our practice that we think it should be better. We think it should be comfortable, or we should be getting somewhere, at least not falling asleep, and just daydreaming about after sesshin. So at that time, if we think it should be some other way, and we're getting really discouraged, then. How grateful we are that we see, I'm getting off track. These thoughts are like the flesh and blood of the Dharmakaya coming to me. And what's on top of that thought? There's a lotus flower. Okay. Thank you all for your practice. As we approach the longest night of the year, may our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to say.